And then I'm also going to go ahead and put us on universal mute. So speakers, I believe you have to press star 6. Would like to unmute yourself. Okay, so let's go through the agenda. Welcome again, everybody, to the Interfaith Immigration Coalition webinar. We're going to start by talking a little bit about the attack on sanctuary cities, and I'll talk a little about that, and then into the Syrian refugee crisis, where we have Jens Myers, the Director of Policy and Advocacy for Church World Service, our immigration refugee program. She'll talk about that. Then we have the Central American humanitarian crisis, and we're very glad that Daniela, and I hope I get your name right here, Daniela Bergi Palomino, Senior Associate of Mexico Migrant Rights, Border Issues, Latin America, with the Latin American Working Group. So we're glad that she can join us. And then I think you all probably know Reverend Dr. Sharon Stanley Ray, who will talk a bit about family detention and where we're at that, and she is the director for the Refugee and Immigration Ministries of the Christian Church and the Disciples of Christ. And my name is Reverend Noel Anderson. I'm the National Grassroots Coordinator for Church World Service. And go on to the next slide here, where we really get into what has been something that has continued to grow is this attack on sanctuary cities. And we see this now in the Senate. It passed something similar, passed the House a couple months ago, and now we have the right before August recess, and now we have this Stop Sanctuary Policies and Protect Americans Act, S-2146. It was getting tossed around in Senate Judiciary Committee. The Republicans were having trouble deciding on it. One of the reasons was some people wanted the 5-year mandatory minimum sentencing for all those who were deported and wanted to reenter, to reunify with their family. If they are caught in those attempts, they want to make it a 5-year mandatory minimum for illegal reentry, which is really disconcerting. The other thing that they want to do is basically defund all sanctuary cities, which would try to block any community policing policies, such as the detainer policies we have in the 320-plus jurisdictions that limits their relationship with immigration customs enforcement. And they essentially want to say, no, you can't be a sanctuary city, and we're going to defund you and punish you if you are. And this is a vote that's scheduled for tomorrow at 2 p.m., and we'll be sending out an action alert. Probably some of you have already gotten an action alert from your organizations. And we're hoping that the Democrats are going to filibuster this. We've heard that they are planning to, so we're hoping that they do, and we're trying to shore up support. So calling all of your senators in this time period will be really important. With that, we're also seeing this, a lot of this stems from, you know, the Stanley death, the tragic killing in San Francisco. Many people blame that on the sanctuary cities, but there was also a lot of complicated things going on in that case, like that he had found a federal agent's gun and had accidentally shot this firearm that ricocheted and unfortunately killed Stanley, but also that it was a question mark why he was brought back to San Francisco when he was released from the Bureau of Prisons and on an old 20-year-old drug warrant for marijuana possession. So that being said, there across the country we've seen this attack on sanctuary cities, and it really is attack on immigrants, you know, definitely part of the hateful rhetoric that has grown so much in the public debate over the recent months. And so we've seen this now happening at the state level. And so North Carolina, House Bill 318, North Carolina, they passed the Protect North Carolina Workers Act. And this, again, also has some stipulations that attack low-income communities, but it's mainly designed to essentially the provisions will with the community. It has a community ID provision, basically saying that all municipal IDs and community IDs and consular IDs, like matriculas, they often call it in Spanish, wouldn't be valid with government officials. They did amend it to allow community IDs and municipal IDs for law enforcement, but it also has an e-verify that would be mandated for subcontractors of the government, and it would limit the supplemental nutritional assistance program for those adults who may not have children. All that said, it's a really bad bill. And one of the things we're most worried about, we are expecting Governor Pat McCrory to pass it, to sign the bill and make it into a law in the next week or two here. But we're really worried that it's going to spread. And we've seen that in Florida, actually, there's a law that has been introduced, hasn't really moved much at all, but that would actually anybody who has a deportation order and they have not gone and reported to the ICE office would have a felony is what they want to do in Florida. We've seen that about 25 states are looking at potentially pre-filing or filing similar legislation to the North Carolina House Bill 318. And so we really have to, as a faith community, push back against this attack on sanctuary cities. So with that, I want to pass it over to Jen Smyers, and you might have to press *6 to get off mute, Jen, to talk about the Syrian crisis. And that's just a picture there from North Carolina rally. So Jen, very glad that you are with us today, and I know you've been doing so much work on this with RCUS, the Refugee Council USA, and have been holding lots of webinars on this with Church World Service as well. So thanks for being with us. And if you're trying to talk, Jen, we can't hear you yet. I don't know. You might have to press *6. Let me try to take you off mute real quick here. All right, Jen, are you there with us? All right, so Jen doesn't seem to be able to get in with us, so why don't we skip to the next section? I know I did hear Daniela. Daniela, are you here with us?
Hey, no, it's Jen. I just joined.
Oh, great. I was just calling, and so that's perfect time. So yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and mute everyone, Jen, and then if you can press *6. Okay, Jen.
Great. Thanks so much, everyone. Thanks for being on and for talking about these really important displacement issues. I know there's been a lot of attention around Syrian refugees. We all know just from reading the news and being in conversation, this is the largest displacement crisis that we've seen since World War II. Overall, worldwide, there are 60 million people who are displaced. In Syria alone, there are 4 million refugees who have left Syria and are in the region, 8 million people who are internally displaced. This means that Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, the countries around Syria are hosting more than 3 million refugees. We know that Germany has really stepped up to the plate in terms of European partners. They've agreed to host up to 1 million Syrians through various programs. And I like to note that this would be the equivalent, based on each of our country's populations, to the United States welcoming 3 million Syrians. But yet, unfortunately, the U.S. has only resettled 1,911 Syrian refugees. So we do know that the White House has pledged to resettle 10,000 Syrians this fiscal year. They were already planning to resettle about 5,000 to 8,000 Syrians, so this is in no way a sufficient increase, and we're really pushing for more. We can go to the next slide here. So our ask for the White House has been for the White House to admit 100,000 Syrians in addition to the presidential determination. The presidential determination is the number of refugees that the administration determines can be resettled every year. Last year, that was 70,000. This year, it's 85,000, so there is a slight increase. And in FY17, the administration has talked about resettling 100,000. So we know that these are actually pretty low numbers historically. Back in the 1980s, we were resettling closer to 200,000 refugees every year. So we know that if the White House wanted to, they could increase this number really substantially. For instance, in 1980 alone, we airlifted about 200,000 Vietnamese refugees. But unfortunately, we know that I think some of the reticence from the administration to increase this number comes from anti-refugee sentiment and anti-immigrant sentiment and anti-Muslim sentiment in particular when it comes to this population. Next slide. So when we talk about Syrian refugees, there are a lot of creative solutions the administration could take to resettle more Syrians. Again, we're asking for 100,000 Syrians in addition to populations from all over. The administration can increase funding for the UN Refugee Agency to help Syrians abroad, as well as to refer more people to the United States and to other countries for resettlement. The U.S. could increase funding for the Department of Homeland Security to interview and to process Syrians more quickly. Unfortunately, right now it takes between 2 to 3 years for a refugee to go through the very, very rigorous security procedures. The administration could also use some creative solutions in its toolbox to designate a priority 2 category. That's basically just the category that is designated as of particular humanitarian concern. So there are about 20,000 Syrians who have approved immigration petitions who are just awaiting their priority dates. You all know our immigration system is very backlogged and very broken. So people are being processed today who applied for family reunification in 2008. So we could take those applications, people who are just waiting for their priority date to become current, and we could allow them to await that time safely in the United States. The administration could also expand the Priority 3 Family Reunification Program. This is something where a refugee here in the United States can apply for their refugee family members abroad to join them here. But the administration could really interpret this to allow Syrian Americans, regardless of how they entered the United States, maybe they themselves are citizens, maybe they came through a work visa, but if they have family members who are overseas, who are in danger, who are refugees, allowing them to sponsor them to come to the United States. And then very, very important is we want to make sure that all refugees are welcomed adequately. And that means that if we're going to increase the number of refugees, also make sure to really improve upon our commitment to fund the resettlement of those refugees so that they can integrate and thrive in their new communities. So increasing resources for processing as well as resettlement resources for refugees in the U.S. And I think that Senator Lindsey Graham said it very well. He said, if we don't resettle refugees, we might as well take the Statue of Liberty and tear it down. So let's move to the next slide. We want to talk a little bit about some of the funding proposals that we're talking about. Like I said, I think it's very important that when we commit to more refugees, we commit to adequate and quality resettlement of them. Right now, as you all know, the government is operating on a continuing resolution, just fancy phrase for copying and pasting last year's budget into this year's budget. But it's a short-term continuing resolution. It expires on December 11th. So by December 11th, Congress has to pass a full budget for the year. So they could either just do another copy and paste job, or they could actually pass budgets for each of the different government agencies. So this is a real opportunity for us as people who care about Syrian refugees and refugees from all over to make sure that we're adequately funding and advocating for additional funding for the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration under the State Department, the Refugee Corps of the Department of Homeland Security, and the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is under the Department of Health and Human Services. There's already been bipartisan agreement by Senator Leahy and Senator Graham to introduce a $1 billion supplemental to help both overseas assistance of Syrian refugees and increase resettlement. And so there's a lot of discussion around making sure that we can adequately fund these refugees to make sure that they can adequately resettle. So this is a really key time for us to push for this. We'll go to the next slide. While we're having conversations with our members of Congress, I want to flag a few pieces of legislation. I'm not going to get too in-depth because there's a lot to cover here, and I know we have more other topics today. But there are four pieces of legislation that are positive. One is the Protecting Religious Minorities Persecuted by ISIS Act, and this would help Syrian and Iraqi refugees who are either religious minorities, ethnic minorities, or people who are fleeing gender-based violence. Which is very important that this is not just for religious minorities. This is for many different populations. And it would not limit resettlement to just the populations. It would just basically increase the capacity for us to resettle not only those populations but others by expanding capacity in the region for those interviews to be conducted. There's also the Strengthening Refugee Resettlement Act, the Refugee Protection Act, and the mouthful, Domestic Refugee Resettlement Reform and Modernization Act. And these last three bills are really bills that would enhance the capacity of our refugee resettlement system to make sure that when refugees are resettled, they can become citizens faster, they can arrive with a green card in hand rather than having to wait a year to apply for a green card, they can have better and more extended case management services, better capacity to be able to find a job, to learn English, etc. I want to move on to the next slide, which is unfortunately about two anti-refugee bills that have been introduced. The Resettlement Accountability National Security Act would basically stop the entire resettlement system. And fortunately, that is not gaining a lot of co-sponsorship or attention. However, the second bill, the Refugee Resettlement Oversight and Security Act, H.R. 3573, is picking up a lot of interest in the House of Representatives. This is a very dangerous bill that would basically politicize the refugee resettlement program by making it so that Congress would have to approve in a joint resolution, both the House and the Senate would have to approve every year how many refugees can be admitted to the United States. Right now, the administration determines that in consultation with Congress, but you can only imagine with political gridlock as it is right now in Congress and in future years, you literally would see the refugee resettlement program grind to a halt, and it could really be used as a political bargaining chip, and we don't want to see that. The other very troubling part about this piece of legislation is that specifically for refugees from Iraq and from Syria, it would say that the U.S. should only prioritize religious minorities. And we can all read between the lines that this is something that's directed to limit or restrict altogether Muslims from accessing refugee resettlement in the U.S. So I'm really proud that there are more than 400 religious leaders who have signed on to a very powerful letter telling Congress that we are against anything that would restrict access to refugee resettlement to people based on their religious tradition. And we want to make sure that Muslim refugees and refugees of all faiths have access to life-saving protection. There's a link here, and I'll also put it in the chat function as soon as I finish talking, where you can sign on or encourage your faith leader to sign on if you don't see them on there already. Moving on to the next slide, just to kind of wrap up all of our different asks when it comes to refugees, there are a few helpful points that if you're not as familiar with how the refugee resettlement system works, it could be really helpful to have in your back pocket to answer questions. I've heard so many different questions about security checks, and I think it's important to reiterate that refugees are the most scrutinize and vetted individuals to enter the United States. All refugees undergo rigorous security screenings, including in-person interviews with Department of Homeland Security officials, fingerprinting, name checks, background checks, interagency checks. It's a really, really rigorous process. The other thing I think to mention is that there is really broad community support for refugees, employers, congregations, schools, communities welcoming refugees. Refugees also are not a burden. I think that it's really unfortunate when people treat refugees as though they're just someone to be taken care of. Refugees are actually thriving members of our communities that provide economic support for our communities, revitalize communities, and are really fully part of our neighborhood. So I think there are a lot of great people to lift up, like the founder of Google, the founder of Intel, Albert Einstein. All of these people were refugees, but even beyond the superstars, the average refugee is an ingrained part of our community and really helpful in contributing back to their communities. So in sum, we'll move to the next slide. One more thing here, sorry. So I mentioned anti-refugee sentiment. I know you all have heard maybe anti-refugee or anti-Muslim comments really getting whipped up right now in particular. There are a lot of anti-immigrant groups that members USA and the Federation of Americans for Immigration Reform add to those, you know, Act for America, this anti-Muslim group, and Refugee Resettlement Watch, which has been shown by the Southern Poverty Law Center to be a group connected to a lot of nativist and hate groups. So there's a great piece that the Southern Poverty Law Center has done on specifically Refugee Resettlement Watch that I would encourage people to read and to be at least aware of some of the accusations that people are bringing to refugees and to be able to be strong faith leaders in opposition to these hateful voices. And then I think I'm finally ready for my last slide here on what are our current asks, what can we do. Everyone can call the White House and urge the president to admit more Syrian refugees. There's a great Refugee Council USA congressional toolkit where we can try to meet with our members of Congress. They will be home the week of November 9th, so it's a great way to be able to meet with them and urge your community members to call their members of Congress as well, because we know that the White House will act, especially if they hear from members of Congress that we want there to be more Syrians welcome, that we support the resettlement program, that we're against anti-Muslim or anti-refugee proposals. Moving on to the last, almost next to last slide here. We know that there's a lot that people can also do in having your voice heard through opinion editorials, having your voice heard on social media, and there's some great hashtags we've been using, hashtag America Welcomes, hashtag Refugees Welcome, and hashtag Welcome World. And on America Welcomes in particular, I think there's some beautiful pictures of different people holding up signs saying that refugees are welcome in my community. And then the last slide here, I just have some helpful resources that people might want to use, including the Refugee Council USA Congressional Toolkit. And we also have a call coming up if you're more interested in the weeds, refugee resettlement advocacy issues. There's a call coming up on November 7th, and we'll make sure to send it around to the Interfaith Immigration Coalition list as well. So with that, I will turn it back to you, Noel.
Thanks so much, Jen. I really appreciate that. I have so much detail in it, and you've been such a great leader on this issue. And I know many of our folk in the Interfaith Immigration Coalition have been involved on this and have been working on this. And maybe just because that is a lot of information, maybe we could just take one or two questions, and then we'll save anything else for the end. So I'm gonna unmute you all for.
Unmuted.
All right, so one or two questions for Jen.
Good question.
So I see a good question here about the call on Friday, November 6th or Saturday, November 7th, and that's probably just a calendaring. On our part, the call will be on Friday.
Whoops, sorry, Jen. I guess you got to press star 6 again. Sorry.
I'm good. So the call will be on Friday, November 6th at 12 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And I and if you're on the Interfaith Immigration Coalition list, we'll make sure that you get it. And I will also type in my email here. And if you are not on that list, but you want to make sure you get information for the call, you can email me for it as well.
Okay, and if you have another question, press star 6, please, because there's just too much background noise. Or you can put it in the join.me message system. Okay, well, I'm not hearing much there, so I think that's good because we do have a lot of material to cover, and happy that Daniela from LOG, the Latin American Working Group, is with us today. With no further ado, Daniela, you might have to press star 6. All right, Daniela, we can't quite hear you yet, so if you're with us.
Can you hear me now? I think I'm.
Aha, yes.
Okay, great. Thanks, Noel. Thanks so much for having me here, and thanks for raising these very important issues on this call, and I think, importantly, side by side, so we can get a picture of what's happening around the world and how these issues need to be continue to be highlighted, especially the connections, I think, within some of the work. So I'm going to be talking about the Central America refugee crises and going to be covering exactly why it's a refugee crisis, how Central Americans and under what conditions they're migrating to the U.S. And elsewhere, and then talking a little bit about the U.S. policy influences that have both as a response to the humanitarian crisis and that have also kind of spurred and fostered some of the very dangerous conditions that migrants are facing en route to the U.S. So first, just as a very brief reminder of what is the state, the current state in of violence and that citizens are facing in the Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, which are all very small countries of, you know, population 6 million, 8 million, Guatemala a little bit more, so where you really feel, people really feel the impact of these high rates of violence, and where there's been serious governance challenges now for some time, countries like Honduras, where 80% of crimes are not brought to a complaint because citizens don't have trust in the authorities. And where corruption is, you know, runs across various sectors. These countries now, so particularly El Salvador and Honduras, have some of the highest homicide and are, I believe, the highest homicide rates per capita in the world. We know that in El Salvador, 900 people were killed alone in the month of August, and where we're seeing homicide rates now that are higher than those in the Civil War and that are, you know, in comments you begin to hear them compared to situations of conflict, for example, the Colombian conflict, that, you know, the homicide rates in these countries are rivaling and higher than those. And what we're seeing, and the violence is, in El Salvador, it's mainly due to, it's gang violence between two main gangs there, the Mara Salvatrucha and the Barrio 18 gangs. In the other two countries, it's a mixture of organized crime and gang violence. And the governments really have responded and have increasingly responded with an aggressive crackdown against this type of violence, where military and armed forces are increasingly being used to take on the roles of police, and where, you know, young men particularly are being targeted. In El Salvador, gang members are now recognized as terrorists. Terrorist activity, and so that gives the government the leeway to target any, you know, sort of young men or anyone who might be suspected being related to this gang violence, and really gives them the leeway for, you know, kind of attacking young men or really anyone who's related to the police, young women who are in relationships with gang members, and it's leaving citizens in a situation where they really have nowhere to go, and where they don't trust to get a response from police or any sort of law enforcement authority. And El Salvador and Honduras now, I'm going to talk a little bit, obviously, about the route and migrants leaving to come to the U.S., but particularly El Salvador and Honduras are, we're seeing situations of internal displacement, which means that people are leaving their homes, their communities, to go to neighboring ones. But as I said, these are smaller countries, and there really is nowhere to go. There's no safe shelter. The government hasn't provided any sort of safe shelter in El Salvador. It hasn't even officially recognized internal displacement from violence. And in Honduras, it is recognizing it, but we still lack statistics. Right now, it's very anecdotal, 50 families leaving a particular municipality at a time, 20 here, 50 there, which still, again, for these countries, they're quite high. And just to add, not only are people coming to the U.S., but there's been a 1,200% increase in asylum requests to neighboring Central American countries of Costa Rica, Nicaragua, and Panama, who are also starting to receive these migrants. So moving on to what exactly does it look like for Central Americans to transit through Mexico. Now, this has been, this is not, as we all know, a new humanitarian crisis. Central Americans have for some time, due to the violence in Mexico, faced robbery, kidnapping, rape, and trafficking while crossing through Mexico. We all remember the pictures of migrants sitting on top of the bestia or the train and transiting in that way and facing situations where organized crime and police, migration enforcement, is handing them over to organized crime and extorting them for ransom or holding them for ransom. This has been going on for some time, but what's happened in the last year, since July 2014, which is when Mexico's southern border plan was implemented, is that this border plan really institutionalized, under the narrative of protecting migrant rights, it institutionalized a sort of free-for-all to go after migrants crossing Mexico. And under this plan, Mexico stepped up its migration enforcement by deploying 300 agents at the southern border, increasing checkpoints and along the southern border states, forcing and increasing apprehensions of migrants by 70%. And what this has done is that it's forced migrants to take more dangerous and isolated routes through Mexico that are no longer along where the migrant shelters had been and along the routes of the train. And they're not receiving any protection. And when migrants are detained, basically what we're hearing from our partners on the ground is that they are not given information about how to request asylum, and they're actually even often encouraged from doing it and told that if they request asylum, they'll just spend, you know, months and months waiting in detention. It's not worth it. And so they're repatriated and deported back to Central America very quickly. So what this has caused is that migrant shelters, especially in the south, really have become sort of refugee camps where migrants end up waiting for months at a time to figure out what their situation is. Very few asylum claims have been processed and granted. There's high withdrawal rates because, again, migrants are scared and told that they shouldn't apply or don't have a lot of information on it. And deportations back to Central America are happening in situations and conditions in violation of international refugee law, in violation of Mexico's own migration law. We've seen a doubling of the amount of deportations of Central Americans to Central America that Mexico has taken on, 92,000 from October 2014 to this past summer, to 2015, which is a doubling, particularly high levels of children. And the way that these deportations are happening are, again, within very quick time period and often bringing Central Americans back to the very dangerous conditions that they were fleeing. We've now have, there are no official statistics, and you can imagine it's very hard to track what happens to Central Americans that are deported back to their countries. But you might have seen a couple of recent news articles where Elizabeth Kennedy, social scientist, has begun to track these numbers. And deportations from, she said the deportations from Mexico and the U.S. in the last 21 months have returned about 90 migrants who have been killed within the next couple, you know, within returning to their countries, they've been killed within days, often as little as 24 hours or less than that, again, because these are people fleeing, and when they flee, they leave with very little property and information. They're kind of told that, you know, their family is being targeted and that they have no time to leave. You know, manage to make it into Mexico and are deported within very quickly, and, you know, gangs find out about their return and they're killed. So people are being deported to their death. So this is a little bit of what migrants are experiencing through Mexico, and if we go to the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about what has influenced this entire situation. So a couple of things. The U.S. has basically, at the root of the 2014 so-called unaccompanied migrant crisis, which was when last summer, you might remember, 68,000 unaccompanied migrant children from Central America reached the U.S., and there's a lot of media about it, and it's very politicized in several ways. In response to that, the U.S. has taken on a series of measures to really force Mexico to step up its migration enforcement. And we've seen that through comments that Ambassador Tom Shannon has made to a panel of Senate Foreign Relations Committee saying, you know, that we need to improve the ability of Mexico and Guatemala to interdict migrants before they enter Mexico. We have to help Mexico do all it can to strengthen its enforcement. So these are signs and comments of appreciation, and the Mexico-Southern border plan coincided directly, the implementation of it coincided directly with this kind of pressure that came across in comments. There were also public awareness campaigns that formed a part of around this time to kind of dissuade migrants within the Central American countries, to dissuade migrants from coming to the U.S. And more concretely, you know, beyond these comments and beyond the Mexico Southern Border Plan, I'm going to talk a little bit now about funding, which is something, you know, we as organizations have been tracking and are looking to influence continuously over the next couple of months. And that is that the U.S. obviously has been giving Mexico large sums of money through the Merit Initiative since 2008. One of the pillars of the Merit Initiative was focused on strengthening, you know, focused on the U.S.-Mexico border. That has increasingly seen a shift of that to look at Mexico's southern border. And within that, we know that for through the fiscal year 2015 appropriations legislation, $86 billion were given in support for Mexico's southern border strategy through INL. And that, you know, that kind of support has gone for equipment, biometric, scans, helicopters, patrol boats, information technology, that kind of support, again, to step up the enforcement. For fiscal year 2016, it's not official. We know that DOS has included another $80 million from INL to create a 21st century border. Again, a lot of this goes with the language of 21st century border. But moving forward, we're going to want to keep tracking this, and new ambassador to Mexico, Roberta Jacobson, has made it clear that assisting the southern border is going to be continuously a strategy and importance for the future. So we also know that there's been U.S. support and training to for the Honduran and Guatemalan border, and specifically the three Honduran law enforcement units that received training and were supported with also funding from USINL. And that went to an operation to intercept children and families trying to cross from Honduras to Guatemala. So again, that's another specific migration funding and support that went to try to stop migration flows from those two countries to even enter Mexico. And that's involved, you know, training from U.S. Border Patrol, U.S. ICE, and other law enforcement. So that specific is a little bit specific to the migration aspect of it. Now, to address the root cause of migration, there's been a Central American aid package, which was announced in January 2015 when Obama announced $1 billion aid package to go to these three countries, which would have tripled the assistance that the U.S. had been giving Central America in the past. And that obviously is something that we're still looking to influence. It's not fully shaped by any means. And we're going to be seeing how it's reconciled. Particularly, it was supposed to have a lot of development assistance included in it, but we know that the U.S. military has undercut it, and we're going to see how those two versions are reconciled within the coming months. Again, the fight between a focus on security and more development assistance and strengthening borders. The other aspect of that that also was came in response was the Alliance for Prosperity Plan, which was an effort by Obama to say to Central American governments, okay, you need to also step up, and what is it that your governments are going to be doing to address the root causes of migration that's separate from the aid package. Now, the Alliance for Prosperity was developed in conjunction with Interdevelopment Bank, and it has heavy private sector involvement and kind of is looking to create jobs, private sector initiatives, strengthen institutions, and kind of create initiatives of that sort. Now, that was largely developed without consulting civil society, and civil society has a lot of concerns about what sort of economic initiatives that's necessarily going to create and where, again, areas that with the highest level of violence or who specifically is it targeting. The good thing about Central American Aid Package and some of this U.S. funding is that we do, organizations like us, advocacy groups, are using human rights requirements that also are part of these appropriations bills. And thankfully, we're going to be using those to sort of track how the funding and where the funding is going. So I'll just end with just one more point. And the other sort of the response to this humanitarian crisis of last summer was implementing these in-country refugee processing programs for minors, for Central American minors, which was a way that the U.S. said, you know, that Central American migrants could apply to receive asylum protection being within the countries as opposed to traveling through Mexico. But unfortunately, this program has a lot of difficult requirements. One of the children have to have a parent legally present in the U.S. There has to be DNA testing to confirm the relationship between the parent and child. And there's a couple of other serious costs involved, which, as you can imagine, when people are in situations that they need to flee immediately, they cannot be waiting around for months, nor do they have often the capacity to fulfill these requirements wait around and to get this asylum. So I'm not going to talk too much about family detention because I know we have another speaker. But basically all this is to say that we have been working a lot to kind of make the argument of how the U.S. has been pressuring Mexico to step up its migration enforcement and really kind of transfer the problem from the U.S.-Mexico borders, for, you know, asking Mexico to do its dirty work, basically. And in doing so has placed a lot of Central American migrants in danger, in direct harm, in violation of a lot of international laws. And also we're going to be tracking the funding, some of the pieces of funding that I mentioned, and seeing how we can influence it and really bring up the stories that we're hearing from the ground to make sure that migrants' protections are included. And one thing that you can do immediately is that we have a petition going right now, and we'd love for you to sign it. Again, this is to raise awareness on the situation in the region, and particularly the U.S.'s role in influencing it. And we encourage you to sign it and also take a look at a couple of the recent news articles that have been coming out about this recently. So thank you.
Thank you, Daniela. That was a great presentation. I think really caught us up to speed about what's happened over the last year, and it's very disconcerting. So I think however folk can get active on this issue would be very important. And one of the ways we know that people can be active on this issue at the domestic level is regarding family detention. And so I'd like to pass it over to Reverend Dr. Sharon Stanley Ray, who has been doing excellent work along with Detention Watch Network and many other organizations as well on this, trying to stop family detention. And we have had some victories on that, and we need to really keep up the pressure. So Dr. Stanley Ray, you might have to press *6. We still can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, now we can.
All right, perfect. Well, thank you, Noel, and thanks to everybody for plugging in on these calls As you can clearly hear, there are a number of issues that are at a very hot point right now and need your involvement, so thanks for giving your time. As we just heard from Daniela, the international challenges in the Northern Triangle, as they continue to grow in levels of violence, as it becomes more difficult for folks to escape that violence because of our U.S. policies often, we also know that our policies within the country, our policies of caring for Central American moms and how we receive them into the U.S., what we do with them as they are here, continue to be in so many ways deficient and appalling. And as faith communities have been, I think, particularly consistent in raising our voices to say they are really inhumane. And as we've seen the United States turn back to the model of family detention that we had given up years ago. And as we look at what has been going on, particularly through the end of the summer and the beginning of fall, it's impossible not to think of something like ping pong. There's been so much back and forth with the voice, the, I think, wonderful voice of Judge Dolly G, from the U.S. District Court issuing a ruling on July 24th, a 25-page ruling that clearly said to the administration, very bluntly, the behavior that the administration has taken in using the practice of family detention is out of compliance with the many years old Flores settlement. In early August, the administration hit back and with a request for a reconsideration of Judge G's ruling. They said, oh, we're trying to move families through detention as quickly as we can. Give us some break. In August, the 21st, Judge G responded back again. She refused the administration's request at this point. She gave a ruling that said, again, that the Obama administration's family detention policy was clearly in breach of the Flores Agreement. The agreement had said and mandated that children not be kept in unlicensed facilities and that they should be kept only for a very limited amount of time. Really importantly, in Judge G's response from August 21st, was her messaging that the administration has until October 23rd, of course, now this Friday, in order to comply. And a little after the middle of September, on the 18th, Secretary of Homeland Security issued several paragraphs saying that, oh, we are complying with Judge G's August ruling. We are turning the three centers into short-term, their language was used, to be processing centers. And Judge Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay, asked the Justice Department to appeal the August ruling. And he said, again, we're still committed to reforming our practices of family detention, but we're disagreeing with the legal reasoning that Judge G had given in her case. So we know that folks like Bob Goodlatte, the Republican chair in the House of the House Judiciary Committee, has been continuing to urge the administration, along with a number of other voices, in pushing back against Judge G's ruling. And this week becomes extremely important to look for what we may hear from Judge G in this week, or will Jay Johnson fully comply? Or if not, it seems that the case will then next go to the San Francisco Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals to try to get an easing of the deadline that Judge G had given of the 23rd of October. And we'll go to the next slide. So in the midst of this time, in this very, very important week, there are a number of invitations we want to put out. One of them is to consider regathering our faith community voices that really have been consistent on this issue through a number of months. We want to make sure that the White House hears very strongly and forcefully in this week and urge faith communities to call the White House or to email the White House before October 23rd to ask again that the administration would pull back from appealing Judge Gee's decision and to restate our deep faith commitments to humane care for the mothers and the kids, and that really means closing the Dilley, the Carnes City, and the Berks County Family Detention Centers, and as well as an additional way to help to regather our faith voices. The image that you see on the top right of the screen is one that has just been produced by one of our disciples clergy, and he has offered it to be utilized for End Family Detention Now campaigns by different denominations. To do that, just email to me, and he has told us that he will be happy to put your own, send your logo. He'll put your logo on the poster, and you also can use that for your own campaigns. We'll go to the next slide. As the next slide gets ready to change, we want to invite you to remember that this week is the National Week to End Family Detention, a time when we can all coalesce and unify around the hashtag End Family Detention message and can really work in many ways around the country to speak out against family detention. There is a Facebook link that you see at the top of this slide. On that slide, you can gain access to many of the details related to actions that are happening all around the country this week. I want to especially invite folks to a national conference call, which will happen at 11 a.m. tomorrow. On that call, which is being sponsored by Raices organization in Texas, there will be frontline attorneys, some released families who will be speaking, a member of Congress who will discuss the practice of family detention, and especially how we can continue the strong push to try to end and close all of the detention centers. If you live in Dallas, Texas, there's an event that's happening there tomorrow night. On Wednesday in Minneapolis, an event is happening at the Midtown Global Market. In Washington, D.C., on Thursday, we'll be marching from the U.S. Department of Justice to the White House in a rally to end family detention. And also on Thursday in San Antonio, there will be a panel discussion and a film screening about the realities of family detention. On Friday in New York City, some moms who themselves have been detained will be available both to speak out as well as to participate in a legal services clinic that's being held on the campus of Columbia University Law School. And if you live in Memphis, Tennessee, there's a candlelight vigil on Friday at the National Civil Rights Museum. We know as well that Cleveland, Nashville definitely have other events planned, and you see the emails that you can contact in order to get additional details. If you would like to hold an event yourself anywhere in the country, please do that. You can go to the Facebook link at the top to do that, or you can contact Mo at raicesintexas.org, and you see his email at the bottom. And we'll go to the next slide. In the meantime, advocates are pushing back very strongly among each of the three detention centers related to Dilley, to Carnes City, and to Berks County Family Detention Center, to try to make sure that the centers do not either maintain or continue to retain licensing given. The state of Texas is in the process of considering providing licensing, a kind of emergency licensing for the family detention centers to be allowing children to be cared for in those centers. We know that a letter already went out the end of last week from more than 140 organizations and individuals to the state of Texas officials to ask them to not give a license to the private prison companies who are operating the family detention camps, both Dilley and Carnes City. But there is an opportunity, and we strongly encourage you to push this out, to send your own message to Texas Governor Greg Abbott and the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services Commissioner, and there is a link to sign that petition below. And we'll go to the last slide, which tells us about what's happening on the Berks County Family Detention Center front. Advocacy groups there in Pennsylvania have a letter to Ted Dallas, who is the Pennsylvania Secretary of the Department of Human Services. In this case, they're asking him to revoke the license that the Berks County Detention Center currently has, and there is a contact person listed there that you can contact to learn more. You can also, through the Google Doc at the top, sign on to that letter yourself and add your voice to the many others. No matter where you are in the country, our Pennsylvania advocates are inviting us as faith community members to please sign on and register our voices on this important human rights issue. Noel, I'll turn it back over to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Reverend Dr. Sharon Stanley Ray. Great to have you so involved on this and sharing so much information. Unfortunately, we have gone a little bit over our time here, and I apologize. That I'm sure has something to do with the technical difficulties in the beginning there. If people would like to stay on for a few minutes, we could probably still ask a couple questions. I don't know if our speakers had to run or not, but we could see if we can get a couple questions in and before we call it a day here. So if you would, there is a lot of background noise, so please press star 6 if you have any questions.
Noel, this is Sharon again. Can you hear
mm-hmm.
me?
Yeah.
I just want to put out an invitation to everyone. This is related to our refugee advocacy issues that Jen pointed to so beautifully, and toss out that we're in the IIC in the process of preparing materials to send for congregations and worship communities to use to consider holding a welcome weekend for refugees on November the 13th through the 15th. So just a heads up, stay tuned for those resources, and we expect them to be coming out at the beginning of next week.
And I see one more question for you here, Sharon, on the messaging here. It's wondering about Dilley and Carnes. They're attempting to get licensed to be child care spaces officially, I guess, and so there's some concern about this and GEO Group getting government contracts, you know, for this. What do you know much about that?
Absolutely. And I really hope that perhaps on a future webinar we can have some folks who have been working on the contracting issue for the care and contracts and significant amount of funds that have gone for those contracts to the prison companies for case management. And I know that Clinic is working on that very much through Ashley Feasley. And in the meantime, I think these the licensing efforts that Dilley and Carnes are in the process of really need to be pushed back on, and the petition against licensing the family detention centers is one that I think needs to have all of us weigh in.
Great. And I also saw a question for Daniela regarding the U.S. International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. Do you want to just say a word about what's entailed with that?
Well, it was just when I was mentioning the funding that has gone to both law enforcement, Mexican Migration Enforcement, so the Mexican Migration Institute, and then also to Honduran agencies, both to technology and training and to, within this line of stopping migrants from reaching the U.S. and having both of those countries, Mexico and Honduras, step up their migration enforcement and people from leaving and getting too far. So it's just one one agency through which the U.S. is sending or providing this kind of funding.
Got it. All right. Thanks. Are there any other questions out there?
Hi, Noel. This is Patrick. Another question for Danielle.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yes, yes, go for it.
Yeah. You mentioned Elizabeth Kennedy. Do you have is she at a university or a suggestion of how one could find the research she's doing?
She is. She was referenced in a couple of the recent articles that have come out. One of them that Sonia Nazario published called Refugees at Our Door.
I saw that one, but I didn't see her name mentioned. Yeah, okay, I'll look back. Yeah.
In that one, I believe she's at a university. I'm forgetting the exact name of it right now.
In Texas somewhere. But this is part of her research was done through a Fulbright grant, so she will be publishing soon.
She did a lot of her research. She was in El Salvador for a long time, and now she's been focusing specifically on this. She's been doing this research tracking media reports, again, because there is no way of tracking what happens to migrants that are deported back to Central America, but I apologize. I'm forgetting the exact name of the university where she's at. But
okay.
It's forthcoming, so there's nothing, I think, official on it yet. That was just a preliminary figure that she's put out in those articles.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, other questions like that? If you do want to say something, it's star 6. All right. Well, I think we've had a really informative webinar today. Of course, these are issues that are very pressing in our times regarding migration and the humanitarian crisis that we're seeing both from Central America and in Syria. And I think there are quite a bit of action steps that we have before us. As people of faith, we, of course, have a moral obligation to act. And I think that most of you all are already doing amazing work out there. We will send out the PowerPoint so that you can have this as a resource as well as the recording of today's call. And that way you can have that and pass it on if you need to. And I would definitely encourage you all, you know, we will be sending out another action alert tomorrow morning regarding this to stop the attack on sanctuary cities. So please be part of that. And any petitions that were mentioned today, please find out how to sign on to those. God bless you all in the struggle for immigrant and refugee rights as we continue on in our work. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Noel.
And a special thanks to our speakers, Daniela, Sharon, Jen. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take care.